Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. When was the last time you saw an art exhibit that really captured your imagination? One of the many beautiful things about living here in the Piedmont is that you don't have to fly to the Louvre, MoMA, or Guggenheim to recreate that magic. Plus, oftentimes, it's free. Sika, Delta Arts Center, Sawtooth, Weatherspoon, Elsewhere, Green Hill, and the list of great gallery spaces in the Triad goes on and on. And today we'll take a stroll through some of the best. Curator Allison Slaby walks us through the fascinating history of genre art. Painter Rick Freeman brings the sights and sounds of the Chitlin Circuit alive with oil on canvas. Colombian artist Oscar Munoz reflects on the ephemeral nature of life. And George Shear and Stephanie Sherman want to share their living museum inside a thrift store with you. Next on Triad Arts Weekend, after this news. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and I gotta say that covering visual art through sound on the radio does come with its fair share of challenges. But thankfully, when the individuals bringing the art to life are as knowledgeable and passionate about their work as Rinalda House Museum of American Art curator Allison Slaby, you'd think art was just made for radio. Rinalda House is one of the top museums of American art in the world, right here in our own backyard. 2 years ago, Allison sized up the collection there and came up with Virtue, Vice, Wisdom, and Folly, the moralizing tradition in American art. The original exhibition drew mainly from the museum's amazing collection of genre art. 200 years earlier, genre art was alive and well in 17th century Holland, and the complimentary exhibition of Dutch prints from that era, Moralizing in the Age of Rembrandt, Dutch prints from the Auckland Art Museum, displayed concurrently for several months. So what exactly is genre art, and how did it reflect the tenor of the times? I dropped by the Mary and Charlie Babcock Wing for a tour, and our guide, Allison Slaby, had the answers to those questions and many, many more. We start here with Life in the Country and a really large canvas.
Yes, well, we've spent some time talking about genre art and the definition of genre art, and then we begin the exhibition with a landscape painting from our collection here at Rinalda House by Thomas Cole, who's really considered the father of the Hudson River School of Painting. But he included these wonderful genre elements in his paintings. And so here you have a painting called A Home in the Woods from 1847, which has a cabin and a family gathered around the cabin and a father returning home at the end of the day with a fresh catch. And it's really talking about the effects of settlement on the land. Cole was very concerned with the kind of move into the country's interior and the effect that this would have on these unspoiled natural places. And in 1837, he wrote an essay called The Ravages of the Axe, in which he really lamented the disappearance of these unspoiled places. And that's what he's talking about with this painting.
Wow, and the date?
1847.
A forward looker. Yeah, so it's Dad bringing home the bacon, but in this case, fish from the lake. It's a beautiful landscape. It does have echoes of the Andes of Ecuador in kind of an American form.
Absolutely. Cole was Church's teacher, so that's why you see his influence on Frederick Church.
And we're moving on to something very different, and this is the card players, the piece that kind of struck me in that we've got two card players dressed by today's standards in semi-formal or formal garb, but in a it looks like a ravaged, kind of blown out shack setting there. It's an interesting juxtaposition. They're playing cards. They're both wearing hats and evening. One has an evening coat. One is wearing a vest. And yet the scene couldn't be more ramshackle.
That's true, and that's kind of the point of the painting. So you have these two men playing cards, and it seems fairly benign at first, until you notice the coins on the table between them. So they're not just playing cards, they're gambling. And there's a jug under the table, so they're drinking too. And there's a trash barrel in which you can see a discarded piece of paper with the word sermon on it. They've thrown the sermon away. And worst of all, the hearth, which, as we've already mentioned, is the heart of the home, is crumbling. So they're really neglecting their duties to the farm and to their families and even their faith in favor of this scheme to make some easy money. And what's interesting to me about the creation of this painting, when and where it was created, William Sidney Mount was from Long Island. And Long Island in the 1830s and 40s was a place of enormous land speculation. So people were buying up land hoping to flip it and, make some easy money.
Sounding familiar.
I know. So we can think about the gambling as referencing this larger practice of land speculation, these schemes to get rich quick, which were really pervasive in the 19th century. And there was a lot of discourse in the contemporary press about this land speculation would do damage to the moral feelings of young men. And so you can see that the house is kind of crumbling around them. So I think if the gambling references land speculation, the house is potentially the country and the damage to the country.
Sort of like the East Coast version of what was going on the West Coast with the gold rush.
Absolutely. And it's about the same time, 1845 to 50 is the date of the painting. Well, we're in our section here on men and women, and we're really talking about what's the proper sphere for men, what's the proper sphere for women, and what's the proper sphere for interaction between the two. And here we have an example of what happens when you get out of that proper sphere. So you have a man on the street, and he's returning from the market, and he is just not doing a very good job. He has a basket that he has managed to lose his grip on. The tomato and the eggs have already hit the pavement. He's about to lose his hold on the chicken. What's worse, it's raining, and there's a man behind him who's smirking because the marketer can't get his umbrella up because his arms are too full. So, you know, what's interesting to me about the painting is that you have the work of a woman, Lily Martin Spencer, who was herself working outside of the proper sphere because she was a professional. She was an artist and working as a professional artist. So why is she interested in satirizing what happens when you get out of those proper spheres? And this kind of comic image was typical of genre painting before the Civil War. And so I think she's interested in this kind of comedy, broad comedy in painting.
Yeah, when you look at it that way, it's sort of like a Saturday Night Live skit in a sense. But it is interesting. It does draw the question, why would she? So it's a joke within a joke. I mean, she's making fun of those who would make fun of a man just for shopping?
I think so. She's, you know, it's kind of a wink and a nod to the viewer.
Love it. I'm struck always by the contemporary nature of the jabs and the humor that you see in so many of these.
Absolutely. And you know, when you do a little bit of digging about the, you know, as I said, the cultural and historic context, so much is revealed.
Oh, I love this one. This is the Alfred Jones.
Well, in our section on politics and patriotism, we have two prints. And prints are very important in the 19th century, especially with this idea of moralizing, because a painter could produce one, maybe two paintings on a particular subject. But a printmaker could produce thousands. So the painter would create the image, and then he would commission a printmaker to do an engraving of the image. And this particular painting, which is called War News from Mexico, was reproduced in print. The first print run was 14,000. So the idea that lots of people had access to art for the first time really reinforces this idea of the democratization of art in the 19th century, that it was accessible, that it was cheaper, and that you could hang a print in your own home, framed, just like you would a painting. So this is an enormously important painting in 19th century American art called War News from Mexico, and it's really about people gathering to listen to news of the Mexican-American War. And so what you see is a group of men gathered on the porch of the American Hotel, and they're gathered under the overhang, so they're standing under its protection. But outside of the porch, you see a black man and his daughter, and leaning out of a window, you see a white woman. And they are standing outside of the protection of the American Hotel because they're standing outside of the American political process. The Mexican-American War brought about the issue of new territories being added to the nation and which of the territories would be slave states and which would be free states. And these people cannot participate in that political process because they cannot vote. So that's the point that Woodville is making with the position of the figures within the image.
To be clear, would Woodville have held a conservative viewpoint, an activist viewpoint? What was his political bent?
I think you can get the answer to that question by really looking at the image, especially by looking at the face of the African-American man, the father. He's portrayed so sympathetically with this expression that's really a mixture of anxiety about what these developments might mean, but also perhaps hope. What might it mean for him if he moved west? Would there be new opportunities for him? So I think that wonderful sympathetic portrayal gives us a clue as to Woodville's stance on the issue.
This is a work by Eastman Johnson, The Storyteller of the Camp Maple Sugar Camp.
It was a work that was part of a larger study that Johnson was doing at the time. He was hoping to produce a large study of the maple sugar camps in the backwoods of Maine. And so he did several studies in preparation for this larger work. So what you see here is a group of people who have gathered around the sugaring off, the tapping of the maple trees to produce maple syrup and maple sugar. And there's a kind of large bombastic storyteller in the center, and he's quite an amusing character. But if you notice the dates of the painting, 1861 to 66, that's a very significant time period. That's the middle, the dates of the Civil War.
Again, getting back to the contemporary nature of so much of what I'm seeing today, by that I'm just talking about 20th century, this mix of realism in terms of the face of this young woman here could almost be a photograph, you know, realism, and then it fades off into a blur in the background, and you've got these abstract representations of, you know, human figures falling off into the shadows, and the use of light and the color choices. It's really a neat combination of textures.
He's an enormously talented artist, Johnson. He did work over decades and was one of the most influential American painters of the 19th century.
So you've got good taste. Okay, so moralizing in the age of Rembrandt. We get to the second half of the exhibit, which draws on Dutch artists. And I thought it was an interesting pairing. The parallels you draw are just uncanny.
Well, this is something that's so fun for me as an art historian. I work at Rinalda House Museum of American Art, so we look at American art. But for this exhibition, we did a complimentary exhibition of 17th century Dutch prints, and really looking at the way these artists in Holland in the 17th century were doing the same thing with their images, that they were offering examples of good behavior or bad behavior. And there are lots of similarities between 17th century Holland and 19th century America. And these are models that American artists in the 19th century would have seen and used. And they're just fascinating and lots of fun for us to have here at Rinalda House. The 17th century Dutch prints came from the Ackland Art Museum just in Chapel Hill, so they have a wonderful collection, and you know, this is just more evidence of the wealth of museums in our area.
And you mentioned that 19th century American artists or the American public would have come across these paintings. Where would they have seen them?
In private collections. People would have had prints like these in their homes, and they would have been available for people to study.
That's right. They're prints, so they may have been actually affordable for middle class as well, or just upper class?
Probably upper classes would have had this kind of material, the Dutch material, in the 19th century in America.
Okay. Let's continue our exhibition tour. And we're standing in front of one of these beautifully detailed prints. That's something about so many of the Dutch painters from that period and even earlier, the amount of detail that they get. It's just staggering.
It is amazing. It's supposed to convey to you the idea that you're seeing an actual scene. But as we know from our discussion, it is a fiction. It's a carefully constructed fiction. So this is a work by an artist named Cornelis Visscher called The Pastry Cook. And it's about 1650. We're not sure of the date. But it's a domestic scene. You see an older woman seated, surrounded by other family members, a little boy who's eating a pancake. And he's probably eaten a few in his life. He's a little bit round. There's an older man who's smoking a pipe. There's a young woman who's glancing suggestively and flirtatiously out the window at a man who's looking in over the doorway. And so there's lots of examples of bad behavior going on here, overindulgence of all kinds. And the question is, why would an art buyer have been interested in an image like this that depicts peasants overindulging? And, you know, I think a possibility is that he could take vicarious pleasure in this kind of sensual indulgence, which was taboo in, you know, Dutch Calvinist society. But he could also reassure himself of his own moral upstanding position, that he himself is a man of great moral character.
That's great. I wonder whether back then they were forecasting this idea of photography. I mean, there's so many details there. I wonder if anyone ever even conceptualized it. Do we know from writings whether the idea of capturing an image without drawing it out came about? Was it ever talked about?
Well, we do know that there were artists in the 17th century, artists like Vermeer, who were using the camera obscura. So it wasn't a device that created a permanent image, but it did allow them to see an image in almost a photographic way. So we end with this really fun interactive gallery where we really wanted to get people thinking more deeply about the material, but letting them have a chance to put their hands on some of the images themselves. So in this section we have an interactive wall where you can take reproductions of images from the exhibition and put them in the category that you think best suits them, virtue, vice, wisdom, or folly. We also have a journaling activity where you can sit and reflect on images from the exhibition, but some really fun leading questions like who does the grocery shopping in your house or where do you get your daily news. We have a listening station where people can sit and listen to music inspired by the exhibition. And then the last thing that we did was for kids. And when you come in with kids, you are given a rucksack and you can take it through the exhibition and do a scavenger hunt. So you go through and you pull out the top, and then you have to go find which painting has the top or the banjo or the rubber chicken. So it's lots of fun. Yeah.
Like a little scavenger hunt in the arts.
Yeah, and there are great questions included in the rucksack that parents and grandparents and caretakers can really engage kids with the meaning of the objects in the exhibition. And then the last thing that we have is we have days of storytelling next week on the November 20th, where kids are invited into the museum and we have storytellers telling tales inspired by the images in the exhibition.
Rinalda House Museum of American Art curator Allison Slaby. Virtue, Vice, Wisdom, and Folly, the moralizing tradition in American art, has since come and gone, and Rinalda is currently planning its new exhibition, Things Wondrous and Humble, American Still Life. It opens August 8th through December 8th. The exhibition will feature some of the finest examples of still life from collections all across our state. Things Wondrous will explore both traditional and unexpected approaches to still life, and you'll find links to more at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and after this short break, we'll return to the gallery. This time, we get a look at visual art from the artist's perspective. Our tour guide will be painter Rick Freeman. Rick has long been fascinated by blues music, and his work chronicles the sounds of the blues in its heyday and the musicians who made them, next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and today we're surveying some of the many fine art galleries and museums in the Triad with the artists and curators who bring it all to life. As so often happens with the arts, various artistic disciplines often draw from one another for inspiration. Romantic composers drew on Romantic literature. The Impressionists in visual art and composition at the turn of the last century egged each other on. And our next little Pictures at an Exhibition tour comes from a painter who pays tribute to the blues. For more than 40 years, Winston-Salem Delta Fine Arts has been enriching lives by stimulating interest throughout the entire community in American arts and humanities, with a special emphasis on the contributions of African Americans. The Chitlin Circuit Review is a series of brightly colored, often large-scale oil paintings based on blues music by acclaimed Athens, Georgia native artist Rick Freeman. His work recently graced the walls at Delta Arts, and each of his paintings is his visual interpretation of the early history of this great music. The Chitlin Circuit was the collective name given to performance venues throughout the eastern and southern United States that were safe for African-American musicians to perform in from the late 1800s to the 1960s. In Rick's review, he portrays the social and political realities of African-Americans in the Deep South. He spoke with me by cell phone from his home in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, a lot of it has as much, if not more so, to do with the people that live in and around the Chitlin Circuit, and that actually made the music what it was. The blues told the stories of their lives. I'm not painting. I'm part of the paintbrush. I'm a tool. And it just goes and it comes. And then you just look at things and say, okay, and just let it flow. Let it flow. Let it do what it's gonna do. You know, let it do what it's gonna do, baby.
Early this morning, when you knocked upon my door.
I saw a documentary on the blues, and it showed this guy on a street corner in Memphis or St. Louis, had a piece of cardboard out, and he was dancing on the cardboard, and then he popped up on his head and started spinning on his head, like the old breakdancers did back in the late 1970s, except this was 1908. It was one of those old grainy black and white, and a chill went up my spine, and I thought, there's nothing new that we're doing now that hasn't been done before. The blues is something I grew up with. I'm from Georgia, Athens, Georgia. And like a lot of folks, when you grow up with something, you don't exactly appreciate it until you get older. At the time that I saw this documentary, a lot of my work revolved around socio-political issues. And a number of friends had told me, said, Rick, a lot of people like, agree with what it is you're painting, but you will never, ever be able to make a living because if somebody, particularly in Washington, D.C., which is where I was living and still do live, if you're dealing with government bureaucracy and all this, that, and the other every day, the last thing you want to do when you come home is see an image that's going to just reverberate what you just went through all day long. You know, a painting is not like a book. You know, you can close a book. Music, you can turn the radio off, you can turn your stereo off, but the painting, you know, and I tend to paint large, you can't just take that off the wall.
We wish we could take you inside, but nobody's allowed in while they're rehearsing, you see.
Do something that you know, something that you feel. If you're an actor, play a character to where you can relate to that character, whether it's good, bad, indifferent, relate to that character. If you're a writer, write about what you know. If you're a painter, paint about what you know. I know about the blues, and I know about Southern life, and Southern black life. And so I thought, this is something I know. This is a part of me, a part of my history, a part of the history of America. And I started researching it and thinking, you know, about just the things I grew up with. And the more and more I looked at it in research, the history of the blues, the history of the Chitlin' Circuit, and just realizing the impact that the music has made, not just on America, but on the world. And of course, it was a lot of the Brits, from the Beatles to the Who in Europe, they were influenced by the blues, and then they came over to America and brought the blues back, or brought it back to the front line of American music, and exposed a lot of Americans to the blues. Something that was growing up right in our own backyard, but a lot of people, again, growing up with it, didn't appreciate it.
Got my mojo working, but I just don't work on you.
But I looked at that and I thought about the impact of that music and what it has on world music. And then I started thinking, you know, of modern music, the blues has had the largest impact on modern music than anything. It's kind of like it's the grandfather or great-grandfather, depending. And it doesn't matter if you're listening to grunge, to rhythm and blues of the 60s or 70s, which came directly out of the blues and early rock and roll, or if you're listening to rap music now.
The big man arrives, disco dancers greet him.
To me, it was just as important, whether I'm painting the blues, and like I said earlier, I do a lot of murals, looking at it from the aspect of everyday people. Because to me, the names in the history books, the names in the newspapers, the figureheads and that kind of thing are very important, and they're leaders of whatever particular movement. But they're not the ones that actually make the movement. You know, it's the people that go through day to day, that go out and have to suffer, that go out and have to confront the law and get their heads beat in and thrown into jail for this, that, and the other, or fight the wars, or and that kind of thing. The general gets the headline, but it's that troop that's on the ground, sleeping in the mud, and possibly dying or killing in the mud. That's the one who's going through all the BS. To me, that's just is so much a part of the history of everything, the history of the world. It wouldn't be built. Nothing would get done without those everyday folks. And that's the way I wanted to look at this series, from that viewpoint of these are the people that make this music. This is what this music is about, because it is a music that's about suffering. I think it was B.B. King that says, everybody in the world has blues.
Thrill is gone. Thrill is gone.
You can take the blues and you can go to Ghana. People understand the blues. You take it to Poland. People understand the blues. You take it to China, Japan. People understand the blues. And none of them have anything directly in common with African-American folks in the South. But they all understand the blues, and that's because it's something, I think, that goes through the core of humanity. You know, everybody understands suffering, and everybody understands how to overcome suffering by getting happy, you know, about something. And blues is a strange dichotomy of a music that on one hand can be so sorrowful, but on another hand it could be, you know, so happy and so uplifting and make you think that there is a brighter day.
Artist Rick Freeman. His exhibit, The Chitlin' Circuit Review, was on display at Winston-Salem Delta Fine Arts, and he spoke with me about it in 2010. Since 1972, Delta has been enriching the triad through the arts and humanities with an emphasis on contributions made by African Americans. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend, where you can also see examples of Rick's incredible historical murals, including the three-level stairwell mural at the Arlington County Courthouse and his 8-foot by 8-foot mural at the Washington, D.C. Convention Center. Delta Arts Center is currently collaborating with Second Spring Arts to celebrate the talents and creativity of our community's seniors, specifically their contributions in literature and visual arts. The visual arts exhibit hosted at the Delta Arts Center showcases more than 100 artworks, including quilts, paintings, mixed media, photography, and more. Some of the artworks will be juried and given awards, and some works are also for sale. Tomorrow, Saturday, May 25th, is the last day of Second Spring's 4-day festival. And as most exhibits at Delta, this one is free and open to the public. You'll find links to more on our website. Again, that's WFDD.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Glad to be along with you on this, well, unusual edition of Triad Arts Weekend. Today it's all about the art, visual art that is, and few describe it better for radio than my next guests. Contemporary visual artist Oscar Munoz lives and works in Cali, Colombia, but his work is spreading fast with shows all across Europe and the United States, including the incredible Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art in Winston-Salem. SECA's 2011 spring exhibit was titled Oscar Munoz, Imprints for a Fleeting Memorial. It showcased the artist's ingenious use of water, fire, mirrors, sifted charcoal dust, and sugar cubes to create simple and yet sincere forms of memorial. With these fleeting materials, Munoz testifies to the tensions found in the cycle of life. Munoz curator Jose Roca and SECA's outgoing curator of contemporary art, Stephen Maticio, spoke with me about Oscar Munoz and his work.
Actually, I'm shuttling between three cities now, Bogota, Philadelphia, where I'm still sort of working on Philagraphica, this citywide event on contemporary printmaking, and Porto Alegre in Brazil, where I'm doing the Mercosul Biennial by the end of this year. And they are totally different cities, but I feel at home in each one of them because I've been sort of going there for so long now.
If you think about the essence of a city or something, you did, just the first thing that comes to mind, I'm just going to say Bogota.
Oh, chaos.
Okay.
A very chaotic city, but very interesting at the same time. And people are really very open to other people, especially people that come from abroad, because Colombia never had big immigration. So there is what I call xenophilia, which is love for foreigners. So you would love it there if you go.
Great. And when you first said chaos, I thought you said cows.
I'm
from Wisconsin, and I
too,
thought,
yeah.
Cows, Bogota. Yeah, I could see that, but chaos.
Chaos,
yeah.
Chaos,
and how about Philadelphia?
Well, Philadelphia is a very nice city, one of the most European of the American cities, so you can walk, you can bike, and that's what I like about it. And there is a sense of camaraderie. that makes that you, when you are part of the art scene, you know everyone. There are no layers, you know, as there would be, for example, in New York, where there are several, you know, groups. In Philadelphia, you feel that you belong to that community from the top down, you know, and all across the board.
And it was in Sao Paulo. Where are you in Brazil?
In Porto Alegre, which is the least Brazilian of the Brazilian cities, because it's located in the south, and the culture is much closer to Argentina and Uruguay. You know, it's the pampa, the cows, the milonga, mate, you know, that culture.
How about that?
It's completely different to the tropical Brazil of the forest, the beach, samba, and caipirinha.
It's such a huge country.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
Do you ever listen to Manu Chao? Is that an artist you know?
Yeah, I know him very well.
I love that guy. Have you met him?
Well, once he was giving a concert in Bogota, and we coincided in one of the salsa haunts. Je ne t'aime plus, mon amour.
Je ne t'aime plus tous les jours.
Parfois j'aimerais mourir pour ne plus rien avoir. Parfois j'aimerais mourir pour plus jamais te voir. Je ne t'aime plus, mon amour.
I want you to take me back to Cali in the 60s and the Ciudad Solares, the group that really kind of brought into focus some ideas.
Yeah, Cali in the end of the 60s and during the 70s was a really vibrant place for culture. They had the very well-known at the time Biennial of Graphic Arts, so they were interested in printmaking, and they also were interested in cinema. They had a movement that nowadays it's referred to as Caliwood, because so many experimental filmmakers were coming out of Cali. All these people like Andrés Caicedo and Carlos Mayolo and Luis Ospina sort of coalesced around like a cultural place called Ciudad Solar, Solar City, and Oscar Muñoz and Fernel Franco and others as well. So that was like a really hotbed for all things creative in Cali at that time. And many of them, I would say all of them, became really well known in their respective fields.
Talk me through how that association, and I know that Oscar was, you know, in tune with the philosophical discussions going on at the time, how that transferred into charcoal technique.
Well, I would say he was trained as an artist and gained some notoriety at that time during the 70s as a master draftsman. He made wonderful drawings, large-scale drawings in charcoal. But you would say that it was very traditional in approach. Even though he was mastering his technique, it was still drawings with charcoal on paper. The subject matter was tenement houses and houses of prostitution, brothels. Many of those drawings were based on photographs that were taken by Fernel Franco, who died recently, and Harvard University just did a show on his work.
He was a member of Ciudad Solares.
He was also a member of Ciudad Solares, and he was a guy that came from a very humble origin, and he had the eye for that subject matter, and I think he sort of was a reality check for all of those who were sort of evolving around Ciudad Solar, Oscar included. So I would say that from that moment, Oscar's work retained some of the characteristics that are present today, like his mastery of the technique, his interest in black and white, in chiaroscuro, in rendering the image, and also an interest on social issues.
I find it really interesting that transition from drawing and the influence of photography and video and how it just all blends so seamlessly, so organically. Is that what struck you on first notice when we came across Oscar's work?
Very much so, yeah. I think about, in North America, we're very seduced by spectacle and by technology, and there's this fear of empty spaces. And when I came across Oscar's work, there was this simplicity and this poetry, this real economy of gesture and materials. And even the move from drawing to charcoal powder, now to video, it's becoming more and more immaterial and intangible. And it's that idea of making such a profound effect with such a minimum of materials that it just swept me away. And it resonated in my mind stronger than anything that I had seen for some time. And so I knew that I had to share Oscar with as wide as an audience as possible.
Oscar Muñoz curator Jose Roca and Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art's outgoing curator of contemporary art, Stephen Maticio. Sica is an amazing place. And did I mention that it's free? Through May 26th, you can still see Andreas Nicholas Fischer's Beautiful Reflections exhibit, along with the huge, captivating canvases of Jaco Olivier and Jennifer West. Their concurrent exhibit is titled Afterlife, and there's more. See all that's going on at Seeker right now at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. You'll find links to images of Oscar's incredible work there as well. So as mentioned, after 5 years of curating extraordinarily memorable exhibitions, Seeker recently announced that Stephen Matisio will assume a new curatorial position at the Contemporary Arts Center in Cincinnati, Ohio, beginning June 1st. Congratulations, Stephen. You're amazing at what you do, and the CAC is lucky to have you. On a personal note, I'd like to thank you for helping me to better appreciate the possibilities in contemporary art, community building, and the thoughtfulness behind great curating. And thank you for listening to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and coming up, more great art as described and explained by the artists and curators who enrich our lives every day here in the Triad after this short break. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and today in our All Art program, it's time to go elsewhere. Get set for a wild ride. Elsewhere Artist Collaborative in downtown Greensboro is run by directors George Shear and Stephanie Sherman. In the 1930s, George's grandmother, Sylvia Gray, ran a furniture business and eventually a thrift store in an enormous three-story building at 606 South Elm Street in Greensboro. Sylvia ran the store until her death in 1997. 6 years later, George and Stephanie took a spring break to see the place. With their shared interest in critical theory, philosophy, and American surplus culture, a "Nothing is for sale" sign was quickly put up, and the Carolina Sales Company was transformed into Elsewhere, the living museum. Elsewhere explores creative collaboration through educational initiatives, projects and events, and innovative artist residency programs. I caught up with Stephanie and George at their living museum, Elsewhere. What are you drawn most as a progression or as a lead into this sort of research and practice?
Right. Well, my initial reaction would be to say narrative and literature. We see communities, social forms as narrative bodies, oftentimes as literary bodies.
That we're producing a fiction together. That right. As much as there's a reality that's happening with all of us, we're also constructing stories. And that the things that we do and the moves that we make create and generate stories, and that our lives are as fictive and imaginary as they are real.
That's the power in so much of what you all do for me. I'm just kind of making this realization is you're constructing a fiction which evolves out of a very personal, very real experience, and that fiction tells the experience in a way that others can relate to. Am I going too far on a limb?
Yeah, no, that's, sure. I mean, that's what we're hoping. And we're hoping that it's not an imaginary for me, but it's a shared cultural imaginary. It's where our imaginations can meet. And we're really interested, I think, in everyday objects, everyday life as the place where those intersections are formed.
In this exploration and then reapproaching a specific experience maybe you all had at this amusement park, for example, you're telling much more than just the feeling of that moment. You're broadening it through your research to look for parallels.
Mm-hmm. Sure. There are sites around the world where these sort of cultural experiences were organized, positioned in the structure of the architectures, quite literally, the things that are there, and many of them are abandoned. It is a story that also very much relates, and I think this is where things become broader. It relates to the way that capitalism and social political hierarchies create, produce, and then in some cases abandon what they have created and produced as literally the gaze of capitalism moves to another perspective. And so you end up with amusement parks that are left insolvent. You know, they're neither good to tear up for the raw materials, nor can the land be leased to someone else. So they sit. And yet there's a lot of potential still left in the momentum of what was advancing forward at one point. So I think our store at Elsewhere, same basic story. 58 years of consumption, of bringing in all these objects, of selling different businesses and histories involved in our street, involved in my grandmother's particular existence there. She passes away. No one knows what to do with it. It sits filled up.
Yeah.
Same thing with this amusement park and other sites like it.
You're really telling a broader narrative of a very specific thing, and it never ends, right? I mean, it's an infinite exploration when you look at it.
Absolutely. And it goes, you know, both, like, I think horizontally and vertically. There's amusement parks all over the world that have been abandoned. So there's all these kind of potential latent sites everywhere, but it's also what are the ways in which the things that we create that have these connective modes where do they exist and how do they live? And as we evolve as a culture, what do we leave behind? And how do we use those spaces to the best of their potential? I mean, there is like a sense of, I think, to what we do, a real sense of resource allocation, sustainability, and figuring out what happens so that the world isn't full of junkyards or the world isn't full of places that can't be activated by people.
Okay, well, take me there, Stephanie. I mean, you're in Germany, Berlin. I don't know, just being a tourist walking around and then suddenly you stumble across this place. I mean, talk me through that experience.
Yeah. So in 2007, George and I went to Berlin for about a month because we had heard about how amazing the art scene was there and had a really nice long time to wander around. 2 days before we were set to leave, we had dinner with a couple who we knew through friends of friends, very, very vague relation, and had a pretty horrible time at this dinner party. But we did get this tip that there was an abandoned amusement park. This woman was describing trees growing out through the rides, and George and I looked at each other and said, okay, there was a reason we were at this horrible dinner. That's what it was. And then on Christmas Eve, we met our friend Nick Testerman and decided that we would go and check this place out. And so wandered, finally found the park. It's in Treptow Park, which is on the east side of Berlin. A really, really, I mean, Berlin is enormous, so there's just vast spaces to traverse, and finally found the park, which feels like it's in the middle of the woods. It's down the street from a Soviet memorial, and George can speak to it a little bit more, but is a kind of tribute to the Soviet soldiers who stamped out the Nazi regime. And it's a very monumental, grandiose.
I mean, it's huge. It's palatial grounds, massive gardening, huge grass mounds with a 4-story tall soldier with a gun on one arm, a baby on the other, crushing under his boot a swastika. I mean, it is classic Russian monumentalism at its best.
Right. And then, you know, down a little path and over a couple little hills, there's a big fence, and we start to walk around this fence and see the park. And you can kind of see tracks of roller coasters. The Ferris wheel is probably the most visible thing. And the ticket booths are outside the fence. And I think that's something that we're very excited going forward, is that the ticket booths are immediately accessible to anyone. And they have graffiti on them like everything in Berlin does. But there's a big fence around the whole park, and we hopped it and kind of climbed over and started exploring and taking video and photos. And the amazing thing is being able to walk along the tracks. Like, you can literally climb onto, you know, the roller coaster ride, and you're walking through it and alongside these kind of areas that are just abandoned. Like, there's a Western world in this park that has just been totally shut up. So there's this kind of like strange Wild West theme. It's like a ghost town in the middle of an amusement park. There was dinosaurs that were completely pushed over. They were kind of these like playground fixtures. And those actually were in the recent Berlin Biennial. An artist took those and featured them in the Biennial. So the other interesting thing is that there's already a lot of artists who have worked with this theme, that are already thinking about this place and the kind of mythology and imagination of this place. And so part of our interest in it is, how can we bring those people together who are already responding to the sensation, potentially in the future at the park or in a form? Maybe it's a book, maybe it's a movie, maybe it's a performance festival. We're not sure yet.
Elsewhere sort of extends into a much longer history. My grandmother ran a store here from 1939 until 1997, a series of different inventories spanning that 58-year period of history, a story of surplus, old furniture that was sold here, army surplus and catalog sales in the 40s and 50s, eventually upholstery, clothing, toys, fabrics, ties, knickknacks, books, you name it. When we arrived in 2003, she'd been passed for 6 years. No one had any idea what to do with this space. We faced a massive job of reorganizing all the things, deciding that, in fact, nothing would be for sale, nothing would leave, and we would invite artists from around the world to come and use the resources to create artworks that would be built into the environment in a site-specific manner, and would in fact be available for continued transformation. So a continual repurposing and reuse of the available resources from within this one building.
And Stephanie, beyond the recycling element of the materials within, it's become sort of a record of this neighborhood, this very street.
Yeah, we're trying to not only respond to the history of the objects here in our memories and in our transformations of them, but also create a forum for community dialogue. So there's a very active presence of our neighbors who come in and share stories about the things that they had and also the experience of evolving with us. We've been here for 6 years and definitely been through a lot of transformations from 2.5 years of really just digging through things in a real archaeology of this stuff to this kind of phase of where we've been having lots and lots of artists coming from all over the world who engage this really local dialogue about the things going on in our South Elm neighborhood and growing downtown Greensboro, and really have this outside perspective that starts a fascinating conversation between what's going on globally and what's going on locally. And I guess just the real interesting thing about that is that when we came to this collection, we thought very much that it was a collection of Americana and American cultural surplus, and we found out hosting artists from all over the world that this is actually a global phenomenon, that global capitalism makes all of these kind of objects a real connector for people all over the world who grew up with these things and are interested in exploring how they influence people's lives.
It's not simply just a response to the histories or the objects or people's memory from childhood, but artists are actually having the opportunity to step into an artwork that is evolving and to respond to that artwork in its moment of evolution. So the ability to transform other artists' work, to have to learn the histories of artists that came before them, ideas that were passed along or shared, things that were attempted, traces of works, some parts that have been dismantled or fallen apart or have been rebuilt, to come into that environment and to build within it and upon it, and not simply to put something up and then take it down, but to really have a process of building upon is a unique and site-specific challenge that addresses all the historical questions, all the cultural questions, but also a real community of artists that have evolved over the 6 years since we've been here. Super Piano Bouncy Ball is this fun, interactive game that actually began locally. A friend of ours who worked at a piano shop right down the street refurbishing piano, John Foy's piano, and he came in and began taking objects and building this sound instrument with a group of people, and over time it has evolved and more aspects have been put in, and artists have come and played shows around it. It is one of these things. I mean, our New Year's, we dropped 500 bouncy balls from a pinata that all hit the bouncy ball piano. So it's a fun, and kids love it and people love it. And I mean, for us, it's central in the sense that it really is a creative, fun way that everyone can get involved and be interacting with an artwork.
To describe that further, it's actually the insides of a piano hung upside down with various drum heads strewn in between and chimes, and throw a ball and you're going to create a little symphony. How about a favorite, Stephanie?
I guess a recent favorite is this piece called Plush the Ride, created by two Winston-Salem-based artists who collaborated on making it. And they are very interested in plush and textiles. And they collected all of the stuffed animals from around the space that were kind of strewn about. Nobody really knew what to do or how to care for these guys. And they made kind of these little donut pouches and build a large armature that turns and spins. And so all the donuts with these little stuffed animals stuffed literally inside the kind of fabric casings hang from the armature, and then you can spin it and they all kind of fly around. And it's like watching 100 or so stuffed animals go on a ride. So definitely kind of continuing this amusement park theme. We're very interested in the connection between the museum and amusement and the idea of musing both as an active engagement and a kind of reflective act as well.
I'll add one more piece to offer the counterbalance to that. We have some very serious pieces as they were. There's a work upstairs in the third floor that deals very directly with the large amounts of Army surplus catalog stuff. A artist who had spent 8 years in the Marines as a photographer and did his MFA in the University of New Mexico came to deal specifically with the Army surplus supplies, finding a massive heap of surplus bags, tents, evoking a certain feeling among audiences, even though in some manners it simply is just an inventory of the store that was back in the 40s and 50s. But he took it, he reorganized it, stacked it, created almost a military barracks, setting up all the pieces. The whole thing runs on a photo timer, involves slide projectors that flash when you try to access and open boxes, concealing information, hiding information at the same time, opening up and tagging inventory in each and every Army surplus piece. And so it's been a very emotional piece. And I think we have that fun moment, and at the same time there's also these moments where you're really confronted with a very real history that is very much a part of our cultural existence.
you all are providing an opportunity for people to get to know what's behind the artist, and it's kind of a win-win. The artist gets to hear from viewers what they're getting out of their art. Is that ongoing?
The Artist Conversation is a programming series we've been doing for 3 years. It began with the support of the Tannenbaum-Sternberger Foundation and has been going on since. It is an 18-week series every Friday at 8 o'clock. We feature a different artist or a couple artists who are invited not to simply exhibit their works, but to rather create a conversation between their artwork with audiences. And the focus, I think, of the conversation is to explore media, explore the artist's experience at elsewhere. So it's a very particular, where you talk about someone refining a gesture for years and years, this is about a very particular moment where they've come into a different strange environment and have created a work and had a very immersive experience working within the museum, and to create a manner of interactivity with audiences to explore that and to show what they've been doing and to welcome audiences to experience their work for the first time.
Elsewhere Artist Collaborative directors George Shear and Stephanie Sherman. Elsewhere, 606 South Elm Street in Greensboro explores creative collaboration through educational initiatives, projects and events, and innovative artist residency programs. On Thursday, Elsewhere held a reception for their latest resident, Southern Constellations fellow Melissa Vandenberg. Melissa was born and educated in Detroit. She's a multidisciplinary artist, educator, and curator living in eastern Kentucky. Her studio practice explores national identity, folk art, ancestry, immigration, and the perception of a homeland through everyday materials like fabric, stickers, wood, temporary tattoos, paper, and found objects. She'll be working on site at Elsewhere through June 5th, so stop on by and say hello. A visit to Elsewhere is a mind-blowing experience. It's fun and it's free. You'll find links to the Living Museum at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Well, that's all for today's program. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia, and our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. You'll find podcasts of Triad Arts Weekend along with pictures and lots of helpful links on our website, WFDD.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.